Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 833. This episode is Elijah Wood and Samuel Barnett. They're promoting Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, the Douglas Adams book, which is premiering Saturday, October 22nd at 9 p.m. on BBC America. Katie, what do you have on the Nerdist Community Corkboard?
I got a really cool one. This guy, Brian Cullen, wrote in that a couple weeks ago he started a regular streaming schedule on Twitch to show people how to make monsters. And he would love for people to watch. So far, he does them on Mondays at 9:30, Wednesdays at 1 p.m., and Saturdays at 9:30. And if you go to twitch.tv/TheBrianCullen, and that's C-O-L-I-N, and Brian is B-R-I-A-N, you can find it, and you can find everything. And it looks really cool. He just makes monsters on there, so that's pretty cool. And also, you know, make sure to check out our other shows on the network, Chewing It. They just wrapped Super Troopers 2. They did a bunch of episodes on set with people from the movie, with the rest of the Broken Lizard guys, so make sure to check that out. And also check out Bizarre States. Halloween's coming up. Everybody likes scary shit, so listen to it.
Yeah, come on. You know, Katie's going to be really bummed if you don't listen to what she says, you guys. Do what Katie says.
Yeah, please.
Come on. As I said, Elijah Wood and Samuel Barnett, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, and I'm excited about that show. I like Douglas Adams.
It looks great.
I'm excited. BBC America, used to work there. Good people. Very good people. And this is episode number 833. Elijah Wood, Samuel Barnett, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, BBC America, October 22nd, 9 p.m.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Is
yes, it is.
Let's see.
Look at this shininess.
Wow. Getting one of those.
Oh, that's very nice.
Yes,
yeah,
it does.
Very sexy.
I'll tell you the...
And the dual camera, do you like?
I do. I will tell you the main reason I enjoy it is that the pictures are stunning. And the pictures in low light are particularly
really
fantastic.
Oh, really? Because they're terrible on this. So
yes, yes.
Great.
They're really... shockingly good, I have found.
Oh, nice.
So, like, when we went to Halloween Horror Nights, which is mostly in darkness.
Yes. It's impossible to take photos.
It's impossible to take photos. I got a lot of really good photos there, because it just, you get a lot of really good low light stuff.
Oh, that's
so
awesome.
Amazing.
So I recommend it, you guys.
I want to get the matte black one.
Oh, you want the matte black one.
Yeah. Well, I'm torn between shiny and matte. I can't decide.
Shiny, you know, I'm normally a matte black person.
So would
this
I.
This time
but
I said, I'm going shiny.
I know, I'm seeing
I'm
that.
I'm doing it. I'm going to make it happen this time. And I'm glad I did. Look at all that fingerprinting that's all over the matte. That is a...
Yeah.
But then, you know, you get a phone and then you end up putting a case on it anyway. So
exactly.
So it doesn't even matter. But we're not here to talk about phones. We're here to talk about you guys. How are things going? Things are good.
Good.
Things are really good.
I got to thank you for the Shudder recommendation.
Isn't it incredible?
We joined right after you told me, and we still watch movies on Shudder.
They're incredible.
Have you seen anything lately that you're into?
I haven't, actually. I've been so busy. We wrapped, a month and a half ago?
Yeah.
And then I ended up going to Austin for Fantastic Fest, so I saw a bunch of stuff at Fantastic Fest, but I haven't checked out Shudder in a while.
And how was Fantastic Fest this year?
It was great.
I never get to go. I've never been.
Oh, shit.
No, because it's always during work.
Right.
I can never get away.
But can't you cover it, though? Isn't there, like, Nerdist. Something that you can make an excuse? Like, I need to be there to cover for Nerdist.
For reasons.
This is a work thing.
Yeah. Don't ask. All that's important is that you need to send me there because this is a work thing.
Yeah.
It's very hard for me to... Comedy Central doesn't want me to leave when we have to do shows.
Right. No, I understand.
And it's very hard to convince them to, like, we should just go shoot a show at Fantastic Fest. That's what we really need to do, you guys. But, I always want to go, and everyone always says it's amazing.
It's the best. Yeah.
What did you see this year that you liked?
One of my favorite films was a 3-hour German comedy called Tony Erdmann that I highly recommend people see.
Okay, I'm gonna do that.
It's about 3 hours.
It's about a father and a daughter. The father is divorced from her mother. Beginning of the movie kind of sets up the father character as an eccentric, and they go to his daughter's birthday. She's in her early 30s. She's a businesswoman, constantly traveling, very busy. And he asks her if she's happy. And it's very clear from her answer, she's trying to put on a face, but she's not. She ends up going to, somewhere in Eastern Europe for this business trip, and he just shows up to, like, bring whimsy into her life and make her life miserable. And it's brilliant and heartbreaking and hilarious. And it's 3 hours long.
Oh, my 3 hours in German.
In German.
So you're reading subtitles for 3 hours.
Yeah, but it felt like 3 hours, but it didn't. Like, it was never not entertaining, and the character work is so great, and the comedy in it is so brilliant. A lot of it is situational. She throws herself a birthday, and she invites all these people from work over, and it's so painful. She's trying to put this dress on, and it's a dress that requires a zip in the back, and she's got no one to help her, so she gets a fork out to try and do the zipper, but it doesn't work. And she goes into her bedroom, and it's stuck, and she's trying – someone's knocking at the door, and she's trying to get the dress off to, like, change into another dress, and she decides, F it, I'm just going to answer the door in my panties. So she answers the door in her panties just out of desperation. She's got no choice. And the person whom she answers the door is an employee or a fellow colleague, and is dutifully sort of shocked. And she just goes with it. Like, oh, that's what we're doing here. In order to enter, you have to be naked. And it goes on for like 30 minutes.
In a 3-hour movie. Yes,
yeah. You've got time, I guess.
It's brilliant. I loved it. There's another movie called Playground, which is a Polish film that tracks three children, all kind of from different families that all sort of meet and converge at this school. So you get kind of an individual experience of each child at their home as they then get to school around the same timeline. And it tracks these children who ultimately inflict a great deal of violence onto another child. And it's sort of it's almost akin to Elephant. Have you seen Elephant?
No.
Elephant was a movie that was like an extrapolation on the Columbine murders that followed two kids. Kind of what would that be like if we followed the kids and tracked them through this? It's kind of like that.
Okay.
And the violence in it is so brutal and affecting. And it, yeah, that was one of my favorite films as well, but really intense.
Well, so it was very upbeat for you. German comedies and
Polish bullying movies.
Violent playgrounds.
I saw Arrival too. Have you seen Arrival yet?
No.
God, I want to see that. I haven't
Arrival's
seen that.
Fantastic. A Monster Calls was incredible.
Oh my God.
Which is Bayona's new film.
Have you heard of Back to the Future? No, I'm sorry.
What now?
But you must see a lot of films.
Well, we watch a lot of horror movies.
Right.
Lydia and I watch a ton of horror movies, either on Shudder or just whatever just gets posted on iTunes, and
I still haven't seen the Blair Witch sequel.
No, I haven't.
That one I haven't seen yet either. We watch like really obscure ones. Boy, I guess I should probably watch some of the higher end.
What have you seen?
We saw a movie last night called Lights Out, which was pretty interesting.
Oh, right, based on the short film.
Yeah, exactly, based on the short film. And it was pretty good. And then on Shudder, we saw Wakewood, which was really interesting, about a couple who loses their... this guy's a veterinarian, and it's a guy who plays Littlefinger on Game of Thrones.
Oh, right, yeah.
And that's his name, right, Littlefinger?
Yeah.
Yes. And so their daughter dies, but they move to this village, and this village has this weird ritual where they can bring people back from the dead for 3 days, so you can say your proper goodbye, and it just... And shit goes sideways. And
because you're not supposed to do that.
You're not supposed to do that. You can't. You're not supposed to fuck with nature. And that movie was actually pretty good. But I don't know if Blair Witch is available on.
Not yet. No, because I think it only just came out.
Only just back like home. Yeah,
3 or 4 weeks.
So you're suggesting that we go to a movie theater to watch a movie?
It's
house
radical. I know, but
it is a radical idea. So leave our house and park somewhere. And I don't understand. How does that work? Sit with other people,
yeah,
and have
that's the best bit.
Have to smell them and be near them,
yeah, and hear people eating.
No,
oh lovely.
God, why
love
would anyone
that
want to do that? How do you guys know each other?
I don't know. Have we ever met?
I don't think so. No, we just worked together for God. What was it? 4 months.
4 months in Vancouver
on Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency.
And is that how you guys met?
Yeah, mm-hmm. We met on that.
Oh,
yeah.
You met on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
And then instantly hit it off.
It's funny, we did a screen test. I screen tested for my role with you in LA before I got the part, and I felt like we had really good chemistry in the screen test, but I wasn't sure if I was just kind of bigging myself up and making that up, or if that was like a legitimate feeling, but it turns out it was real.
Yeah,
I think we hit it off really well.
Yeah, you can never know through that process. It's a really, it's basically, it's a blind process.
Yeah.
Because you can feel amazing about something and then... What do you mean they went with someone? But it felt like it was so, yeah, well,
yeah,
it's so yeah true.
They wanted a guy with pointier hair. Like, it's always some sort
absolutely
of a weird thing,
yeah,
that you can't. So you went through the process. You actually, you tested with people.
I did. Mm. Just a couple, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, me and one other guy, I think,
yeah,
for the role in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it a good room? I mean, like, was the room supportive?
Very.
Good. Very.
It was tiny. Felt more like a... like a workshop, is that what they
yes
call it?
That is exactly what they call it, and that is exactly what it
yeah
felt like. Like, we even had like a rehearsal,
yeah,
for our final performance,
which
workshop
seems so strange to me.
So odd,
because yeah, we had that was very bizarre. He came in; it was an evening session,
yep,
which we then found out was a rehearsal for what was the actual screen test the next day. But
when
it was the exact
happen
same group of people.
And the exact
and
same scenes.
And a camera that
yeah
was there the day prior. So we were so puzzled. Like, what did we do?
It was really odd.
It was funny.
Please excuse the ignorance of this question if the answer is obvious to you. Is the British audition process and testing process television, is it similar in any way, or is it
that's
a completely
question
different?
It feels totally different to me.
Oh, thank
like
God
the whole screen testing thing that I have done before and come over to LA and screen tested mm-hmm for stuff and just not landed them until this one. I just don't feel like that happens in the same way back home. There are less people in the room back home.
Right.
When I walked into my first screen test before I tested with you, for this, and there were about 10 to 12 people sitting there.
Seriously?
I was like,
how,
what?
That is so unnecessary.
So scary. Whereas back home, you'd have like 4 or 5
and
at
that,
most.
And that, there's no consideration for the comfort of the individual walking into the room having to be vulnerable
no
or be the character. That is such an uncomfortable
yeah
position to put somebody in.
And it was the tiniest, hottest room.
Can't you watch? Can't the you know, 10 executives watch it on their computer
no,
when they get the
later
late?
Can they have the decency
later
to have like a two-way mirror?
Right.
Or
yes,
something,
right.
You know?
Yes. And we all know they're behind it, but we can pretend they're not.
All yeah auditions in the interrogation rooms.
Yeah.
There's really yeah great. Someone posted. There's a great subreddit called Obscure Media, and someone posted Crispin Glover's screen test from Back to the Future. And it's really crazy because
wow
it's shot on a set, almost like a sitcom style. Like, he moves through a set.
Whoa.
And I don't know who the dude who's reading with him, but someone plays Marty, and it's probably like a casting assistant or something. But the scene feels like it's improvised, where it almost seems like they were just like, just be George McFly. And it's not funny at all. Like, it's just a kind of a serious scene of
weird
Marty going, yeah, Strickland really, oh, I remember him. You should follow the rules, Marty. You got to follow the rules. And that's how you get ahead in life, is following the rules. And it's this really, it just is like the saddest scene. Yeah, but he is totally George McFly in the scene. But it's
wow
almost like, what if Back to the Future was a weird family drama and not
right
at all a sci-fi comedy? It was just like a dark, that's exactly what it felt like. But the whole audition process, I think, is... I feel like they're, I almost feel like they make it harder because it's not like, I mean, when you are doing the thing, when you're shooting Dirk Gently, it's probably not at all like the way it was in the audition scene. It doesn't feel that unnatural. It feels
right.
Very, so you're actually kind of auditioning under false circumstances.
You are.
Yeah. And I'm always amazed that they're able to see beyond that and actually cast the right person.
Yeah.
Given that those circumstances are so artificial and will never be replicated on a set.
No, no. Yeah, it is strange. It's a sort of an archaic process.
Mm. But it's like if you can get through that pressure, you'll be totally fine on the shoot.
Do you still have to audition for anything?
Sure.
You do?
Yeah.
What?
I didn't know that.
Come on.
Yeah.
What idiot makes you audition for anything?
I think the things
name the
that
idiot
are really
right now.
In alphabetical order, what studios they work at. We're going to get to the bottom of this.
I don't know. I think that there's a series of processes. I think independent films are largely uncast, and those things, I'll have offers for smaller films. Bigger films tend to actually be cast ahead of time. You know, if a director has their vision, they oftentimes know exactly who they want, and they kind of precast the film.
Yeah.
And then the things that really matter that are quite big and significant, I still have to audition for those things.
I guess people want to...
Which is fine. Yeah, I mean, ultimately...
I guess people want to hear you read. They just want to... They might have the idea that you'll write for it, but they just have to... hear you.
Yeah. And I also think it's, I don't know, there's something good, there's a good feeling attributed to having to work for something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
That's true.
Do you have, you must have like weird director lunches. I was like, go talk to this director. Just talk about the script.
I've had those. Sure.
Do those amount to anything, or is it just, yeah, we just had a weird lunch?
They amount to something if it's about a specific project. If it's not, if it's kind of a general meeting, that's weird. Mm. And I've had a few of those. Generals are very strange.
I've had generals, and I honestly can't say that they've ever led to anything. It might be kind of tangential or indirect, but it never feels like they've ever led to anything directly.
I guess it's just sort of a... I guess they want to see if... I think in some cases they probably just want to meet you. They
yeah,
just want to meet you
yeah.
and just see, you know.
Yeah.
I have this movie, but here's 10 Lord of the Rings questions. You know, like. The movie I'm writing is about a guy who really loves Lord of the Rings, so he wants to know.
I have had a meeting with a producer, because I have this production company called Spectrevision, and we produce genre films, and we had a meeting with a producer about some specific project that we might get together to produce together. And at the end of this conversation about this project, we're all saying goodbye. We're at like a wine bar. We go outside and he's like, can you wait 1 second? And he pulls out a giant Lord of the Rings poster and asks me to sign it. Which I was like, this is a bit... the context for this is a bit strange. Oh, this professional meeting that we're having about a project. And
did you sign it?
I did, yeah.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah, of course.
I've been...
pretty funny.
I'm about to stalk... I'm about to stalk Quentin Tarantino because he did the podcast last year.
Did he?
And I didn't have our guest book for him to sign. And he's the only person who hasn't signed it in the last, like, 3 years.
Oh.
And the completionist part of my brain is obsessing over the fact that
you need that.
You've got to get him.
But, you know, now I'm starting to picture myself. I kind of walked through, like, calling his assistant and going, like, hey, it's Chris Hardwick. You know, a year ago, and that, like, and there's no there's no dialogue that I've been able to write in my head that does not make me sound insane.
You might just have to go with that. I mean,
I just wanted to say that. Can we say it? Like, I was even trying to concoct. I almost tried to concoct that exact thing. Like, is there a reason I'd need to meet with him? And then at the end go, oh, I remembered I brought this thing and it's not, you know. Now that I've said it on the podcast, I've
you can't
dashed
do that.
All of those all of those hopes. But
or you've increased the odds.
Yes.
I don't know.
Maybe he'll be kind. Did you have a great conversation with him?
We did. He was great. Is there anything that you feel obsessive about that you would be equally ashamed to admit as I have just been ashamed to admit in public? Come on. Well, there's something.
I don't know. I have a really obsessive mind, full stop. So, I don't know. I obsess about everything. Obsessed/worry.
Yes.
Yeah. So,
Do you think that that's just part of the performer's brain, or do you feel like it's a coincidence that most performers are kind of obsessive?
I don't believe in the whole tortured genius thing particularly. Mm. I don't feel like you have to be insane to be brilliant.
Right.
I think you might be brilliant and happen to be insane, and that maybe if you got better from being insane, you might be even more brilliant.
It's possible.
So I don't know. But I think there is a really high proportion of performers and actors who are obsessive and worry and neurotic.
That's interesting.
I love hearing someone speak out against the tortured genius archetype.
It's probably because I'm not a genius. I mean, maybe if I was a genius and tortured, I'd be like, yeah, you have to be tortured to be a genius. But I don't know. I just feel like the more well you get in yourself, the more access you have to yourself and the better you can be. Who knows?
Do you think if you're a genius, you would know it, though? Or do you think you would not know it?
Kanye seems to know.
He seems 100% really convinced.
He seems very sure.
He seems,
okay, so he knows.
Does not seem to be a shadow of a doubt in his mind.
No doubt.
Hey, Kanye, is the verdict out on you still? No, it's not. Okay, good. It's in. And it's unanimous. You feel that you're a genius. But, yeah, I mean, I guess...
Did John Lennon know he was a genius? Did Einstein know he was a genius? You be self-aware and be a genius? Because I think sometimes the notion of being that self-aware is... could be a distraction from what your particular kind of genius is.
Yeah.
To me, it would seem like your ego would get in the way of...
It might be a block.
...of your progress.
Yeah.
Or your ability to fulfill whatever it is that you're brilliant at.
And also, maybe it's other people who put the genius thing on you. Maybe you don't grow up thinking...
Yeah,
I'm so
Professor
clever.
Hawking.
Yeah,
because I think you need a certain amount of humility.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, look at... Well, Steve Jobs was quite... He was an egoist to a certain degree, but he also worked really hard.
Yeah.
He's a rare case of someone who really did espouse... He would reference himself as being brilliant to a certain degree, but he also just worked really hard and made other people work hard. But I do think that if you are overly self-aware, that would just inevitably get in your own way.
And then you couldn't... I think, because if you think you've hit the pinnacle of your...
What keeps you striving?
Yeah. Exactly. Or... How do you know to keep pushing limits if you feel like, well, I guess I pushed every limit there is.
Yeah, I'm a genius.
I'm a genius.
Nothing more to do.
what do I do now?
I'm done.
Some tea or watch a little Netflix. I don't know what happens at that point. And would you want – because I think there's an interesting idea behind the torture genius idea. Would you want to be considered a genius if it also meant you could never really be happy or you could never really feel stable or, you know, like, would you want that along with it?
I'd rather be happy.
Yeah.
Than right.
Yeah, I also don't know that genius is something I've ever wanted to aspire to.
No.
I'm in admiration of those who have that. But I don't think I would want to be a genius.
Because I think
it's also isolating.
It is.
Aside from the tortured aspect, I think part of why they're tortured is because of how isolating being that brilliant at whatever it is that you're brilliant at is.
And it is an ego pursuit. Because, like you said, a genius is something that other people put on you. So if you're striving to have other people put something on you, then you're doing it for them and you're not doing it for, you know, you're not pursuing your work for you.
Mm-hmm.
I think surely balance is the best thing. You can be extremely talented and brilliant at something, which might make you a genius, but you want to be a kind of happy human being, right?
Mm-hmm. I honestly think a lot of people forget that's the goal. Because I think, you know, people get so caught up in things that they think are going to make them happy or things that are going to fix them rather than going, oh, what if I was just happy?
Mm-hmm.
I need that thing to make me happy, so I got to go for that thing. Now I have that thing, but I'm not happy, so I got to get another thing. Yeah, it's a constant...
Well, and I think that the issue with that is that people are... They're confused by the notion of the pursuit of happiness.
Right. Mm.
I don't think happiness is a pursuit. Mm. It is a reaction to the way you live your life. You're going to be unhappy and you're going to be happy.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as being consistently happy or reaching your perfect level of life. You're always evolving. Happiness comes from feeding yourself and also how you treat other people.
Mm. That's very true. And how much you're contributing to whatever it is, you know, that is important to you or contributing to something that's bigger than yourself.
Which is a certain amount of selflessness. Right. I think that makes you happy.
Mm-hmm. That's why I do comedy, because I'm contributing. You fucking asshole.
But I think people get they get off on the wrong track because they're looking for happiness.
Right.
Yeah, agreed.
Instead of just
happiness
being.
Is elusive.
Which is just a fluctuating state
Work
of being.
On yourself mm-hmm. and you'll be happier ultimately.
You know, happiness shouldn't involve an action verb. It should involve a being verb.
Thank you.
Credits.
Thank you. Drop that mic right now. Oh, and you did.
It didn't really work well.
Did it break?
No one ever drops a mic in a mic stand. No. That's the problem, is you're supposed to drop a mic.
Unless you're James Brown, where it like drops and then
and
comes
back
up again.
Because he could do that.
Yeah, and then a guy throws a coat over you.
Right.
And then you throw it off and then jump back and continue to perform.
That's right.
Do you, I mean, DJing is to some degree it is a live performance, but is there a performer aspect to it? I mean, like, do you feel like you don't feel like you're performing at all when you're doing it?
I mean, I don't feel like it feels like a performance, yes. Especially in that feeling of standing backstage. I've often felt like I'm in a band or something. I play a lot in Europe, and I have done over the last couple of years, and we'll play at music venues. So we'll be backstage in the sort of green room area like you would be if you were in a band before going on stage. So I get that feeling, that feeling of like, it's showtime, now we're going on stage to perform. But it doesn't feel like a performance in any other sense. I mean, I'm just playing records.
But it's definitely you providing entertainment, though, isn't it, too?
Yeah, but there's no outward performative element to it.
Right.
You know, there's no...
There's not like a dead mouse head.
There's no show.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no costume. there are no dance moves.
You don't wear a costume?
I don't.
I think you should start wearing costumes.
Should I?
Yeah. Definitely.
But it's... Yeah, I mean, it's performative in the sense that we are curating music for people to dance to.
Right.
And to a certain degree... dancing and enjoying ourselves in the process.
And is that, what do you think is the real, what's the pulp of it for you? Is it just, I'm entertaining people who are going to have a good time? Is there any aspect of like, I can control these people's emotional experience for the next, you know, hour, 2 hours based on how I kind of create this musical arc?
I think it's a series of things. It's, there's a very visceral hearing music you love played at a very loud volume. So there's something very selfish in a way about it. You have a box of records, all things that you're excited about, and being able to play those things at a loud volume is very gratifying. Mm-hmm. And then there's the reaction that you get from people and seeing how over the course of a night you can kind of build people up and take them down and build them back up again. And that is very satisfying as well, because there's it's a symbiotic relationship. There's a kind of a communication happening as you react to how they're reacting, then changes potentially what you're going to play to keep the rest of the night going. And if you get people going at a certain sort of speed and they're really digging it and dancing, that then inspires you to keep that thing going.
And you play everything on vinyl? Do you do all the vinyl?
Yeah, all records.
It is funny to me that vinyl is the thing that I was going to get a record player. And I looked at my house and get a record player. They're surprisingly expensive for a record. Like the
good ones, yeah.
The good ones are. This like resurgence of vinyl over the last, you know, handful of years is really interesting because it is the most analog thing in a digital world. And do you think that's part of it? Is that it's because, you know, they're basically breakable wave files? I mean, do you think there's something about... You know, it's the same people who will always choose to hold a book in their hand or hold a newspaper in their hand. I think it's
connected to that to a certain degree, and that it's physical, it's real, it's tactile.
You like the sound of – the specific sound that a record makes.
I do. Yeah, I do. And playing records versus – I'd played digitally before for years just for fun. Playing vinyl is different because things can go wrong.
Yeah.
The turntables can break down. There can be feedback. It's not perfect, and so it requires a certain level of being super attentive 100% of the time. You can't just press a button and everything works perfectly.
Right.
And I love that. I love that things can go wrong. You're on your toes constantly. You're constantly working. you're looking through your record bag of what's gonna, you know, what you're gonna play next. That record's now skipping. I've got to transition to another record quickly. There's something, there's something ephemeral about it that can change at a moment's notice, and every night's different as a result of that. Given the scenario and the variables that you're dealing with,
making in the moment art out of imperfections. You know what that sounds like? Sounds like genius. Genius.
Oh, I like that reincorporation there. Brilliant.
No, but it is. But I love that idea too, and it's one of the reasons why I love stand up is because you have to be in the moment to do it, and usually when stuff goes wrong, I mean, unless it goes horribly wrong, but usually when stuff goes wrong, that's the best stuff.
Mm. Yes.
So are you, when you guys are doing Dirk Gently, is it very scripted? Are you guys fucking around a lot? Are you looking for imperfections? Are you looking for ways to create in the moment stuff that's not on the page?
I think so. Like, I think actually looking for imperfections is a really good way of putting it, because that's when it gets a little bit exciting. I mean, it's different. I feel like on stage, certainly, because I've done a lot of theatre, and that thing of when it goes wrong in the moment is when you can save it or break it or make it really exciting or do something. It is a little different on camera. It goes wrong, you can cut, you can do it again, or it goes wrong and something really exciting comes out of it. Mm-hmm. So
I think the pursuit of perfection is dumb.
Yeah, it is.
Because I feel like it makes you make unnatural choices for this weird ideal that doesn't really exist, like, you know. And I feel like across every sector, it's like people's looks have to be quote unquote perfect, or this job has to be perfect. But what does any of that mean? What does it mean to be perfect?
Because it's just this idea that someone's got set up in their head of what something's going to be, and it doesn't exist.
And it's also the perfect's also the most boring.
Completely boring. Yeah, and the pursuit of perfection is also this thing of what is – perfection is different to every single person. It should be about pursuit of truth for you, what you feel is going to make that special and how it's going to fulfill you. Those should be the important tenets, not perfection. And I agree, the notion of perfection is boring. It's essentially without blemish. It's without imperfections. Imperfections are beautiful. If you listen to a recording from the 1920s, those are beautiful because it's literally like a primitive microphone and a shitty, you know, primitive recording device capturing a human moment. Nothing perfect about it at all. But my God, what comes through the other side is extraordinary and can't be replicated.
Yeah, and
if they were trying to strive for perfection, if you clean that up with modern technology, suddenly the heart and the soul is removed from
that. Yeah, absolutely. It's not human. Perfection isn't human. And it also, perfection is, again, other people's ideas. Like, you're trying to live what other people's ideas might be about what's perfect. So how do you know when, like, what do you follow? Because I feel like you need some sort of a path to follow to get better, to evolve. So what is that path? Like, what are the daily, you know, like, what choices do you make to strive for to get better at, you know, whatever your craft is?
It's interesting. It's so much about being in the moment, isn't it? It's so much about being present.
Yeah.
If you can strive to be present, then everything that comes along is a surprise and was probably exactly what was meant to happen. But if you can't do that, you're just blocked and locked down into some idea of what you think you're meant to do, or what you're trying to guess other people think you're meant to do.
Right.
So you're in everyone else's thinking the whole time. And actually, one of the things I loved working with you is you're incredibly present. Like, in a scene, it's like you're just so there and willing to just bounce off whatever comes. And I think that's one of the things that hopefully I think comes across. They were the most exciting moments for me on set. I remember certain scenes. There was that one in the woods, episode 5, where Todd and Dirk are bonding. Remember that day well. And but there was a moment where, like, just the end of the scene just felt interesting, because I was about to use the word perfect, but it felt but it felt perfect because it felt like it was so unexpected what came out. It was like we had reached what was in the script, and so often I feel I fall short of what's actually on the page. But suddenly it was like just this moment happened, and there were a few of those for me where I was just like, yes,
where you kind of hit a groove.
Yeah, you just hit something.
You're not thinking about it.
Yeah, and you're not watching yourself, and you're not judging yourself, and it just kind of flows out. And actually, who knows what that even looks like? Because, like we were saying earlier, sometimes things can feel amazing. Actually, they look shit. They just feel amazing. but I think there was that beautiful
that
moment
is definitely
of.
True.
But like, there were some moments where it genuinely felt like this real connection that was going on that just worked with everything around us that was being filmed. And I think there's some really great stuff.
Yeah,
that's what's so challenging, I would imagine, about theater. Is like, yeah, you know, you can sort of you rehearse, and then the first couple performances, everyone's in the moment. But then you get on autopilot. It's like, yeah, you know. How is performance 60 in the moment when you've done it that many times and everyone, you know, wants to go home because they're tired of saying the same words?
Yeah.
So how do you find, I guess engineer is a bad word, but how do you create that in the moment connection when you've done something so many times before?
I mean, I have had practice at this because I tend to do long runs of shows, which in a way is a good thing because it means they've done well. They've been successful. People want to watch them.
Right.
So it's a good thing. But I think what we miss in rehearsal is the missing character is always the audience. So that's the one way of really freshening up something that might feel stale, is having that connection with the audience. But also, again, it's totally about being present. So if I'm on autopilot, then I'm just not there and it's not going to work. And I will come off stage feeling dissatisfied and feeling like I haven't done my job properly. Even if the show went well. And that's why everything is so subjective. Because actually sometimes I can have an autopilot show and that might be the best one. So I don't know.
Right.
I am not the one. I am just not the one to say. Do you know what I mean? It's all about other people's perception. I'm the worst one to judge my own work.
And how you feel is not always cannot always be equated to how it is perceived.
Especially not my feelings. Like, how I feel is like, I've no idea. I can feel that something is appalling and then actually watch it back and go, that was pretty good. Why did that feel so bad? So, I don't know.
So, I guess ignore yourself.
Yeah, totally. But it is about that, isn't it? It's about getting yourself out of the way.
Yeah.
It is. That's getting the ego out of the way. Which is, I think, a constant struggle for all human pursuits, is how do you get that ego out of the way?
Yeah, sure.
Because it basically wants you to feel good in any moment. It wants you to feel like you're the best in any moment, and it will push you to pursue that, which is mostly an empty
it's
pursuit.
A bottomless pit.
Yeah,
it's never enough. It will never be enough for the ego.
It doesn't matter how much money you have, how many awards you have, how many people tell you. It's like, it'll still, but that guy that guy's guy, he's got it figured out, and that guy's going, fuck, I don't know what I'm doing.
I really
I mean, I with the exception of me, I wonder if George Clooney goes home at night and goes, I don't know what I'm fucking doing.
No, George doesn't.
Not George. He's one of the few people that does not. But I think most people are. I think, and that's really comforting to know that most people are in that same boat.
I think so.
What do you feel most? Do you feel most comfortable acting in film on stage? What do you feel most comfortable doing, even if it's not acting? What makes you feel most like you?
That's a great question.
It's a brilliant question. And you know what? Because we were in Vancouver for 4 months, so I was away from, you know, my partner, my friends, my family. I live in London, and we own our apartment. Like, it's taken me years to feel at home in London and to feel settled. And then to be away from that for 4 months was really interesting because I felt, like, anchorless. Mm-hmm. And then I've been back for about 6 weeks or something. That's where I'm most comfortable. I'm just at home. I felt most myself. I got back and saw friends and saw my partner and went and saw my little niece who's 2 years old and just kind of, I don't know, there's something about having
your core.
I did. That's a brilliant way of putting it. I totally got back to my core, and it made me realize how sort of kind of a bit free-floating I'd felt being away for that long.
What about you?
I feel like, wow. I feel like my most myself. It's a great question. I don't think I've ever asked myself that question. Or has it ever been asked of me? But I mean, it isn't necessarily specifically acting. I think it's just being in creative environments, working with other people. What I get out of the process is certainly the connection that we share and those moments creatively. But I also love the entire process. And I love a creative team working towards something together that they believe in. More often than not, you really get that in smaller films, mm-hmm. Where the unit of production is much smaller, and it tends to unify people more clearly. But that is my favorite part of this creative world that we exist in, making something, particularly films, that we care about. So I suppose it's probably a combination of that and being with my family and friends. But it's weird. I don't feel like myself, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? I don't know that there's a place that I need to be. That is getting back to my core, because I feel like I'm always aware of
that's amazing,
my internal life, and even if I'm away from home, making that my home and get and part of that's maybe just years of traveling and getting used to being away from home.
But it's also part of who you are, because it means that you are connected with yourself. Because I agree. I think there is, you know, this job involves a lot of travel if you're lucky to have a lot of travel like that.
And it can be very uprooting, I suppose.
It can. But I...
Hello, Klondike, 4739.
There's a what?
Old-timey phone. Take that, Mr. Hitler.
God, I was being so intense. Thank God the phone
rang. That's what...
No, God, wanking on. No, but I think like there has to be a way of essentially what you're saying, which is staying rooted and connected in yourself, no matter where you are, so that you feel that kind of groundedness, no matter where you are. And that's something I have to work on. And it's definitely something I find easier when I have the people around me that I just love. But also creatively, just to add to that, I think where I'm most comfortable creatively is when there's collaboration. Because I am not an actor who can just do it on his own.
Right.
I'm only as good as the people I'm working with. And that's whether that's the actors, the crew, anyone. And also, I need a director. Otherwise, I could do it myself, and I can't. So I love the collaboration. That is when I feel the most safe and kind of, that's when I feel safe to just be totally vulnerable.
And also, you discover different shades of yourself when you're collaborating because, you know, obviously there's different chemistry that's created when you're working with different groups of people.
And yeah.
It's going to pull different parts of your personality out to sort of contribute to whatever that situation is. Yeah, I hate, like, sitting and writing alone. Fucking hate it.
I don't know how you do that.
No, I don't do it well. Like, I like being in a room and I like kicking ideas around and, you know, like, everyone sort of dogpiling ideas on top of one another. But yeah, that idea of, again, that's sort of the tortured, like, I just need to go to a cabin. And, you know, that's fine. I'm the type of person that just needs to go to a cabin. Go to a cabin.
Yeah.
But I am super energized by other people and what everyone together, sort of Voltrons, you know, to create.
Yeah.
And that, so how many different things is your company working on at the moment?
Oh, God. We've got, I think, in varying stages of development, probably 5 or 6 films.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We've just wrapped a film that we're in post on called Bitch. And then we've got, I think, two or three films that we're starting next year. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, it is. It's great. And that's the other, I mean, that company's 6 years old now, and that's been so gratifying to...
Thinking about schools?
What's that?
Oh, I was just making a dumb joke.
So, yeah, we are.
Six years old. I'm sorry.
Do you live in the right place?
It was perfect.
The second I said it, like something in the back, the tail end of that thought was, it's not worth it.
It was good.
I'm so sorry.
No, but what's gratifying about it is that, you know, I can go away and work on something as an actor like Dirk, but this process is ever... continuing. We're constantly working on something. So in my free time, I have this great creative outlet that sort of never goes away. It's wonderful.
Yeah. And then, you know, when you need something super in the moment, you could go to Europe and DJ.
Right.
God, I remember going to raves when I was in college, and where it was just like you'd watch like dudes 3 and 4 turntables, just, it was fucking incredible.
Yeah, yeah,
and I never did any of the drugs that were associated with the rave scene. So first of all, it was very loud. And but second of all, there really was an incredible amount of skill. And I mean, I know,
especially those guys that are probably turntablists, right? Where they're scratching and
they're scratching, right. And it's like, one record is the bass line of, and this is the melody, and then over here there's like a rhythm section. I mean, it's like,
oh, there's so much skill.
Boy, I really wish I had the tolerance to go out anymore and see stuff.
Yeah.
I just don't. Do you still just go out? Do you just go out?
Occasionally, but I also have a bit of an old man in me, I think. I like being home.
Yeah, me too.
God, me too.
And I do enough. Honestly, I do enough. I'm fortunate enough to travel a lot and work really hard. And so when I have my time, my free time, more often than not, I'd like to stay home and watch a movie or, you know, hang out with friends. The idea of going out all the time, I kind of left that behind. And honestly, it was never really my thing. Even when I was 18, 19, 20, early 20s, which is the time that you're supposed to hit it really hard and go out all the time, I was put off by crowded bars and clubs. Like, I just never liked any of it. Going to see live music, I love, and I still love that. You know, I missed Radiohead when they were in.
Oh, they were so good.
Did you see
it? I did. Saw them at the Shrine.
God damn it.
Fuck.
I finally listened to the album.
A Moon-Shaped Pool.
For four months. I'm going to listen to it. And I did.
I'd come into work.
You on
did.
The way back.
You did it as you planned.
You said, and
as
I
you
did.
Planned.
And it, yeah.
It's extraordinary,
phenomenal.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Radiohead, I don't know why. I have a very specific relationship to that band where I always have to listen to an album like 10 times to get to find whatever it is that Tom's laying down, but it always takes me several times to hook into every song, and I am now at that place with Moon-Shaped Pool. I've just been listening to it, but they were so, I mean, I've seen them a lot.
Me too.
And I think this last performance was the best I've ever seen them as a band.
Wow.
I mean, like, you know, I've seen them, I mean, they always put on a good show, I think. I think they always put on a
good
show.
Oh, I agree, yeah.
But I've seen them sloppier, or Tom's voice has been a little shot. But this time, they were firing on all cylinders. Everyone was spectacular.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah. Do you know them?
I've met them, yeah.
You have?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I don't know them.
Come on.
I don't know them, I bet I've met them.
I bet if we had met Tom, do you know Elijah Wood? You'd go, of course I do.
We've actually DJed around each other a couple of times.
You've totally got him in your phone.
I do not.
If I type TH into your contacts, hey, Tom York is going to come up in your contacts.
I don't, but those guys are amazing. They're incredible.
Now, they're sort of an interesting case study in...
This actually dovetails pretty well into our discussion about sort of what the pursuit should be.
Yes.
And the notion of perfection, actually.
Yes, because I, you know, there are a couple things, you know, knowing that Tom kind of has an obsession with keyboards and different keyboard sounds and digital sounds, and, you know, you hear things on the tracks where you're like, oh, that's what, mostly, sometimes when you listen to music, you can really kind of map back, oh, I see why they put this in. Mm. A lot of stuff with Radiohead, I'm like, I don't know why they thought to add that there. Like, what a weird sort of a, like, that's a band that I feel like is really playing with imperfections. And putting them in places where it's almost too imperfect, but then just at the last second it completely makes sense. But when you go back and they were just like a guitar rock band, like they could have been any 90s guitar rock band.
When they started.
Yes.
Yeah.
Pablo Honey's like, oh, it's a guitar rock. They're guitar rock.
Yep.
What was it about them in particular that made, like, what generated OK Computer? Was it, you know, we want to make a commentary on where we're going in this digital age. And then each album, how do you give your audience what they would expect, and how do you give them what they wouldn't expect at the same time? How do you do that?
I think the secret to their success, and not success in regards to fans and monetary success, but rather artistic success, is that I don't think they ever overly considered their audience. I think that they were always in.
Point.
I think they were always in pursuit of besting themselves constantly. I listened
point.
To an interview.
Maybe that's what geniuses do. Maybe it is, though. You're right. There's something in that where you are. So, it's what
you are
do
not doing
so
it for
pure.
Anyone else but
yourself. It's for you and for your art.
Yeah,
that's it.
And I think that's the key to them. You know, how they got from Pablo Honey to the Bends. I just listened to an interview with Ed O'Brien where he spoke specifically to that, which was basically that they were labeled essentially as a one-hit wonder off of that record because of Creep.
Right.
And they were like, oh, no, 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 no. We're not that. We've got to challenge ourselves. And this is not the best that we can do. And we can do better than this. And they made the Bends. And he said, and it's so simple, and it doesn't necessarily break down the equation, because I suppose any band could make this approach and not have the same results. But he basically said, we wanted to make an album where every single song was the best song on the record, or every single song was a single. Mm. And he's like, we'd failed. The Bends doesn't have, not every song is a single, but that pursuit made that their strongest record. And then from there on out, it also became about deconstruction. And I think that's really important in art as well. If something's working, to not just keep plugging away at the same thing, but to deconstruct it and to constantly create new challenges for yourself so that you're out of your comfort zone. And that can be applied to any art. I feel that way as an actor.
Yeah, definitely.
I feel that way as someone who plays records, any number of those things. Taking yourself out of your comfort zone instantly puts you into this place of having to strive and work. And those sometimes self-imposed challenges is what makes you good eventually.
Right.
You know what I mean?
So true.
Absolutely, because that's where you grow the most during periods of discomfort.
Yep.
And you don't grow that much when you're super comfortable because you just don't feel
totally.
Like you just don't feel like you need to.
And that band has talked about it a lot too, where they would have a song, and it's really interesting to look at it as an outsider. There's a great documentary called Meeting People Is Easy, which is about their tour for OK Computer. And in it, you can see them working on songs, one of which is a song called Manowar. Now, Manowar is like heavily bootleg. They've played it live. Great song. They've never put it on a record. And you see them working on it, and you're like, oh, that's great. That's going to be incredible. But their litmus for their own material is so intense that they scrap it every time. So they literally will scrap things that objectively, from our perspective, we would probably like or would be in the key of Radiohead or would be something we'd expect from them. But they want to subvert that at every step of
– yeah. And
also, that's fascinating. They could so easily make another OK Computer, but they don't. They make Kid A. And they're like, fuck this. We're going to make a record with keyboards and it's going to be a weird krautrock record. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I also think there's something – attractive about the fact that you really get the sense that they don't need you.
Right. Oh, and that just makes us want them even more.
Of course it does.
Right.
Of course it does, I think there's something on a very deep biological level. If someone needs you, it's like, what's wrong with your genes? You must be flawed if you need me. But if someone doesn't need you, it's like, oh, I think I need your DNA. You know, I need whatever you have. You have some sort of a secret. But I feel like you can't engineer that. You can't fake that. Like, you really just, you know, you can't be like, hey, guys, does everyone hear me? I don't need you. You know, like, that doesn't really. Just to make sure everyone over there, can you let that guy know?
I don't need him.
I don't need you, sir. I don't know who you are, but I don't need you. Like, that's different than legitimately not, you know, like, I almost feel like there's a certain amount of narcissism that's involved in the idea of genius that you would think my own idea is so important for me to pursue and sort of fuck everyone
and
else.
And superior to somebody else's.
Mm. Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Mm. Unless they don't, I mean, again, I don't. I've only ever met Tom York one time, and it was a really bad experience.
I don't know.
Well, it was a long time ago. It was 1995. I was working at K-Rock, and I was supposed to – I was at the Acoustic Christmas show.
Oh, God, and, right. You worked at K-Rock?
I did, yeah, from 95 to 98. And I was backstage, and someone was supposed to interview them from K-Rock, and they kind of blew them off.
Mm-hmm.
This was right after Creep blew up. And they were like, hey, Chris, do you want to interview Radiohead? And I was like, yeah, I love Radiohead. And I walked over, and all I said to them was like, hey, nice to meet you. And Tom York stood up and goes, this interview's over. And then he left. And then I don't know what happened. I don't know why he was upset. And I ran into him later that night, and I was like, I don't know what happened, but I'm really sorry. And he just wasn't in the mood for it. So, but they've still always been, you know, in spite of that fact, and for years it tortured me. I would just hear, this interview's over in my head.
Oh, God.
Gutted. Gutted.
Yeah.
That's awful.
That was the thing that would play in my head when I would fail at something.
This interview's over.
Yeah. Oh, God.
But still love that band. But I do wonder if there's a certain amount of, you know, if it's like, you know, you mentioned Kanye, who is, you know, like, he's amazing at what he does. Mm. I don't think there's any question about his narcissism.
Not at all. I love Kanye, but sometimes I think talking about yourself and talking about your art gets in the way of your art. Mm. I would love, because I think that Life of Pablo record's interesting. I think it's flawed, but there's a lot of really great ideas. I would have loved to have heard that record in a vacuum rather than being told how brilliant it is before it came out. Do you know what I mean?
But I
think artists get in their way. Now, granted, there's something, maybe there's a meta art to that that's kind of fascinating. Like the whole Madison Square Garden, the first time he plays the record is in front of a crowd of 3,000 people off of someone's computer. That we live in that world? That's amazing.
Yeah, I also wonder if there's something about the subculture of hip-hop that when you sort of go back and trace, you know, a lot of the music, a lot of the messaging was, you know, look at how amazing I am. Look at all these things I have. Look at how much money I have. Look how huge my
posturing
dick is.
It's
a lot of posturing. And so I wonder if there's some conditioning. But I mean, there's no question that he...
Right, but you don't see Kendrick Lamar doing the same
thing. No, that's true. That's true.
Kendrick just put out a record that fucking slayed.
Yeah.
Hmm. So.
Yeah.
You don't need it.
You don't.
You don't need it, but...
All I'm saying is I wish Tom York would sing about how big his dick is. Should we not? Can we please... Maybe that's an okay computer. Okay, computer, I know my dick is big. Okay, computer, take it down a notch. Yeah, I get it. It's big.
Elijah, you should text him and tell him.
Please text your friend Tom York. But let's talk about Dirk Gently before I release you guys into the streets of Los Angeles, which is on BBC America.
Yes.
And what is the time?
Is it 9 p.m. on October 22nd?
October 22nd at 9 p.m.
on BBC America.
Great. And just sort of, I know the trailer is available online, but I guess just a quick nickel pitch to what the show is, so people... I have a feeling it's a difficult show to describe.
It very much is.
But how was the show pitched to you guys?
It kind of wasn't pitched. I read the pilot script.
Yeah.
In fact, my manager couldn't. She couldn't describe it. She said it's based on a Douglas Adams novel. That was about all. She's like, it's really weird. I don't know what to make of it. I think you'll get it. I read it and I got it, but I don't know that I could describe it.
Yeah, it's not like you could pitch Hitchhiker's Guide to someone.
No.
I mean, at its core, I suppose it's a detective story.
Mm-hmm.
It is a mystery that takes place over the course of the season with a variety of elements that are all in a mix that are all connected to the core of what the case is, driven by, and sort of I'm lost.
I mean,
already.
It is.
I mean, Dirk Gently is at the heart of the story in the sense that all of this activity is sort of surrounding him.
Mm. Yeah, and he's trying to solve this murder of a billionaire.
That was terrible.
No. We will get better at this.
We will.
Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, to use the full title, is about a detective who is really, really bad at detecting. He's terrible at his job, but he has this kind of superpower. So he receives intuitions and messages from the universe that show him how completely, seemingly unrelated things are actually connected.
Mm.
And when he takes on a case, the universe will eventually lead him to the solution. But because he doesn't know what to do with any of these messages or connections that he receives, he needs help, hence the detective agency that he's trying to form, I guess. And the universe tells him that Todd Brotzman is the guy who must help him.
Now, you're going to have to call in your theater training remember how to say that in a fresh way the 60th time that you have to say that by the end of next week.
I have been practicing. And I need to shorten it, right?
You know, it's harder when you're doing junkets and you only have like 3 minutes.
I know.
So
I basically say it's about detectives solving the murder of a billionaire.
No, I feel like
that's the easy way to describe it.
I think a lot of people who listen to this podcast probably have read a Douglas Adams book or two.
I have a feeling,
but I'm always fascinated by his work, and because so much of the voice of those books are sort of it's that sort of meta voice in the book that's very difficult to translate a lot of times when you're putting it on, you know. It's like even the and the versions of Hitchhiker's Guide, the couple, like the old British version and then the more recent film from 10 years ago or whenever it was, they're fun, but it's just like it's so hard to capture everything that's Douglas Adams because he has such a specific point of view. So were you guys able to – how were you able to sort of rein some of that in and throw it onto the TV?
Well, Max Landis has said you can't adapt Douglas Adams because of that, because most of the books are his observations and his take on life.
Yeah.
So there's not enough action, character, and plot in that. So Max has kind of taken the essence of – certainly the essence of the Dirk character, and then the essence of the world that Douglas creates, and gone full freaky on it, full weird, which is brilliant because actually the weirder he's made it, the more authentically Adams it's felt. And I read the books and then I read the pilot and I just went, this is the next mystery Douglas would have written.
Max wrote the pilot?
Oh, yeah.
Max has written the whole season.
Okay, well, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I mean, like, Max's brain seems...
He just gets that world, and he is a super fan
of
those books anyway. So he's just taken the essence and put it on the screen. And in fact, there are loads of Easter eggs for anyone who is, like, a huge Douglas Adams fan. They're not going to be disappointed that we haven't completely adapted the books.
That's great. And Max's brain is so... His brain is that universe. Like
it really is.
Do you remember him trying to explain to us?
Mm.
Well, not trying. He explained the whole of the first season to us, and I just remember going, "I can't follow that." You need to see it visually.
Yes,
he's got it all in his head.
I totally, that makes all the sense in the world to me. Like, I think it would be a challenge for most people to do that, but I completely. Max has that kind of twisted genius that genius.
It's interesting. Yeah.
He is brilliant.
There is no question. Brilliant. Yeah, Max.
I don't know anyone in my life that has a brain that operates that.
No,
way.
Max is a brilliant tornado.
Yeah,
completely.
He is a tornado that happens to be brilliant.
Yeah,
yeah.
But you've had him on the show, I'm assuming.
Yeah, he's been on. Yeah,
you see the show through Elijah's character's eyes, so that's the way in. It is a real world in which bizarre things happen. But as an audience, I think Max has made sure you're always taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
So if Todd Brotzman doesn't know what's going on, the audience won't. And when Todd does, the audience does.
That's a very
good
point.
He's the guide.
And the frustrating thing about Max is he probably wrote the whole season in 2 days.
Yeah, he just has the whole thing held in his head. I mean, he just pisses it out and goes, there it is, it's perfect.
It's done.
Bye. I'm a genius, bye now.
It's like Mozart dictating to Salieri. Where is this coming from? It's like he's dictating from the heavens. But Dirk Gently, October 22nd, BBC America, 9 p.m. This has been a very enlightening conversation.
It has.
And I appreciate you taking time to talk about weird stuff. And you're both geniuses.
Stop it. No, you're a genius.
No, you're a genius.
No,
you're
a genius. Okay, you're a genius. I'm a genius.
I'm a genius for accepting your genius. I'm totally a genius at accepting that.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks,
Chris.
Enjoy
your burrito, everyone. And anything else you want to plug while you're here? Anything else at all?
Oh, go see The Greasy Strangler.
Yeah.
All right.
I need to
see. Do you know about The Greasy Strangler?
No.
It's a film I produced that's out now on VOD and in theaters.
What's
the film about? Oh,
it looks amazing.
It's a very twisted comedy about a father and a son who still live together beyond the point at which they should. The father runs a disco walking tour of Los Angeles. There's in the background of the film, there's a man who covers his naked body in grease and kills people called the Greasy Strangler, who may be the father. And then there's also sort of a love triangle that establishes between the father, son, and one of the patrons of the walking tour. That's the movie.
So it's not for kids.
it's by a filmmaker called Jim Hosking. He's a British director. It's his first feature film, but he's been making shorts and commercials and incredible work for a long time. And it was one of these opportunities to get behind something that probably wouldn't have gotten made because of how fucked up it is and just kind of gross and weird and undefinable. And it's brilliant.
But the trailer looks amazing. So
it's really great.
I can't
the
wait
Greasy
to see
Strangler.
It.
So what we've learned is contribute, collaborate, pursue what you want for you. Fuck the audience.
Yeah.
That's really good.
That's remarkable. We've covered some. Wow.
And stay present, folks.
Stay present and stay present.
And stay
which is,
present.
Which, by the way, this is going to blow your mind a little bit. That's how we end every podcast. We say, enjoy your burrito, which means live in the present.
Oh, I love that.
Full circle. Woo! It's a perfect circle. We're geniuses. We're geniuses.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.